Good morning. I want us to go ahead and get started so we have plenty of time for Kate. My name is Matthew Phillips. I'm a member of the parish here at St. Paul's and on the Adult Formation Committee. So in my former congregation, I used to put together Sunday School series pretty often, and I hadn't done it here yet since moving, but I'm excited to be on the committee and be one of the people who helps create things that we can study together. My approach is simple. I think of the two or three most exciting and engaging people that I know and I'm thinking about at the moment, and then I reverse engineer a series that gives us an excuse to bring them. So the three-week series that we're beginning, The Gospel of Success, is really just an excuse to get Kate Bowler to St. Paul's. The other weeks you don't even need to worry about, especially the third week. That teacher's terrible. But this is really the reason we did it. The idea of this series, The Gospel of Success, and then the individual titles are I hope, obviously, ironic. Success, prosperity, planning, certainty, these are topics that the church has a pretty awkward relationship with, right? We think about those topics a lot, and maybe in our everyday lives they have one set of meanings, but in the context of church, they're much more tough topics for us to think about. So in part what we're doing is part of what Dixon described as the work of peacemakers a couple of weeks ago, holding the gospel in one hand and the newspaper or the stories we hear from our friends or the mouse we use to click Facebook in our other hand and thinking about how those two speak to and relate to each other, but never resolving ourselves to one side or the other, but yet living in that peacemaker tension. We start off guided by Kate Bowler. Kate has an advantage over other people because she's a member of God's favored race. She's just a little smarter, just a little kinder, just a little funnier than most people because she's Canadian. So this is the perfect way to start off. Educated at McAllister College and Yale Divinity School, Kate was then graduated with a Doctor of Philosophy degree from the Episcopal Seminary of North Carolina, which is more commonly known as Duke University. I've noticed a lot of Carolina blue here. I'm going to start establishing allegiances early. After Kate graduated, she succeeded her advisor and mentor at Duke, Grant Wacker, as a professor of American church history. Her work has focused on the prosperity gospel. And while that might seem like a strange topic for a bunch of Episcopalians, just as we are all of us formed by the history of Puritanism in America, we have that work ethic and the sort of social mores of Puritanism, the prosperity gospel movement has shaped a tremendous amount about the American culture that we live in today. Kate pours herself into all of her work, and that didn't stop about a year and a half ago when she was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. Her extraordinary essay in the New York Times, almost exactly a year ago today, Death, the Prosperity Gospel, and Me, chronicled her own journey as it intersects the story of the prosperity gospel. And it was named by the editors of the New York Times as one of their favorite pieces in the newspaper during 2016. It's not like there wasn't some competition in 2016 for favorite newspaper article. So it's my great pleasure to welcome someone I'm honored to have as a teacher and very lucky to call a friend. Please help me, please join me in welcoming Kate Bowler.
Oh, well, hello, my friends. So I normally am the Sunday school pitch hitter for this amazing History of the Prosperity Gospel. It is a lot of jazz hands. There's a PowerPoint presentation that is also very convincing, because that's what I was good at. I wrote the first History of the Prosperity Gospel. I spent about 10 years traveling around interviewing televangelists and megachurch preachers and anywhere where an eagle was flying free in a sanctuary. I once saw Jesus be crucified at 3 and then brought to heaven at 5 by entering a 3 fog machine into a mirrored wall in Orlando. And I have to admit, like, I have such a soft spot for the prosperity gospel. I really do. I love taking seriously what other people naturally make fun of, and I spent most of my time with people in the pews, people in wheelchairs, people in hospital rooms or in boardrooms, asking them what makes their lives tick and what attracted them to this movement in the first place. And what I found, I think fundamentally, was that it wasn't so much about money as it was a theodicy. It was a beautiful explanation for the problem of evil. What happens when things take our lives apart? What can we rely on? And for them, they wanted certainty. They wanted formulas. They wanted a guarantee that God would always reach down and give them the desperate miracle that they were praying for. And so having spent so much time with the people who are considered usually the most loathsome in Christendom, and then having kind of fallen in love with the parishioners who do most of the work, I was just very comfortable in the shiny mega world. And then last year at 35, I got cancer, which was surprising because, I mean, there's just no cancer in my family. So I one day had stomach pain, and then all of a sudden, my life was taken apart. And I have a little boy and a husband I met when I was 15, and a life that I built very carefully. And so I wrote this piece, and it was just like me crying into my laptop by myself. I mean, I didn't think at all about anyone else, because sometimes that's what you do when you're trying to tell the truth. And anyway, so I wrote this piece, and then I never really thought it would be a thing, and then it was a thing, and then millions of people read it, and then thousands of people wrote to me. So I think as many people find that they are when they're in moments of grief, kind of cracked open to the world, and all of a sudden you're the person that everyone goes to tell their horrible, horrible story. Does this sound right to you? Where, you know, you're suffering, and so everyone's aunt is now brought to your attention, and the aunts of the world are not doing well, as far as I can tell. So I got thousands of letters. I still get them every day. And to be totally honest, I know that I'm not really ready to give a talk in public about my horrible, wonderful, beautiful life. But I consider you an extension of my church family. I really do. When we all thought I wasn't going to make it, Matt went up to the bell tower and hammered out this gorgeous hymn for me in the hospital, and I decided at that moment that you all were, thank you so much, that you all were my people. So this year I said no to every like TED Talk version of my tragicomedy, and I said yes to just one thing, and that's being here today. So thank you so much for having me. I just know too that because this is really fresh, I'm not good at being glib about it yet. You know what I mean? So I wrote it down. So I'm not going to pretend that I'm inventing the words in front of you. I find that when I have to recreate them, I have to relive them in some way. So I wrote down what it's meant for me to live, not just as an expert in the theological gospel of certainty, but what it's like to live as a suffering person who has to bump up every day against people's easy explanations. Because the deep irony of me having, as an expert in the prosperity gospel, written about all of the everyday prosperity gospels that people tell me, all that everything happens for a reason, God constantly opening windows, just a world of windows. My favorite comment came from my, got a good friend, Rolf, and he, very early on in his life, had both his legs cut off because of bone cancer. And I'm grateful that I met Rolf early on because his example, the dignity with which he lives his life and he makes people comfortable with who he is, was really inspiring to me. But when I was talking about how everyone kept sending me get well cards that said that God was closing doors and opening windows, he immediately wrote to me and said, "What kind of God is this? How am I supposed to get in through all of these windows that God keeps opening?" And I loved him for that. But that was kind of the irony of what I was living, is I wrote a piece about the irony of people pouring certainty on pain. They see you, they want to resolve you as a theological problem, and so they pour certainty on it. And then, I mean, by they, I mean beautiful, loving, church-going everybody, right? And then, so what did people do in the thousands of letters that I got? They just poured certainty on my pain. So I wrote about what it was like to get all these letters and the kinds of things that people write in get well cards as someone's life is being ground into dust. And on that cheery note, all right, so here's some of it. All right, millions of people read it, thousands of people shared it, and hundreds started writing to me. And almost all began with the same words, "I'm afraid." "I'm afraid of the loss of my parents," writes a young man. "I know I will lose them too someday, and I can't bear the thought." "I'm afraid for my son," says a father from Arkansas. "He's been diagnosed with a brain tumor at 44, which would have been devastating enough if he hadn't already lost his identical twin brother in the same disease a few years ago." These letters sing with unspeakable love in the face of the great separation. "Don't go, don't go, you anchor my life." It feels as though the world has been cracked open and it bleeds and bleeds. Hundreds of emails, letters, pictures, and videos pour into my inbox and campus mailbox. A mother writes about her son dying young of lung cancer. He never smoked. A nurse has survived 10 years past her stage 4 cancer diagnosis, but her healthy husband dies suddenly one day from an undetected brain bleed. A middle-aged woman has buried her son after watching bill collectors hunt him. And hospitals whose treatments would have saved his life reject him. A check from Medicaid arrives in the mail 9 days after his death. Strangers pour out their fury at every stage of their grief. Depression settles on the page like a thick fog. A young man writes to me saying, "I guess I was hoping that God would make something of this, but it's come to nothing." The void is deep, and it is an unmerciful fact that some people have the right to look at me and say, "You're lucky." A young woman explains to me that cancer has stolen her fertility only months before she met the love of her life. If ever she shakes the disease, even for a little, she will try to adopt. "Hold your son close," she says. "You're so fortunate to have him." There is plenty of denial, plenty of deals people attempt to broker with God. "I'm an atheist," writes one man, "but I put it aside and I begged God to take my cancer away from my son and to put it in me." I read that letter to my dad, who was sitting close to me, sitting on a chair with a Kindle 2 inches from his glasses. "Oh, I've prayed that hundreds of times. Please, God, why not just take me?" he says a little wistfully. I scoot over beside him and rest my head on his knee. "Oh, Dad, that's about the kindest, saddest thing I've ever heard." There's a gentle silence between us as I imagine that we are both thinking about how much we love each other before my dad begins to speak. But then I remember that God didn't spare Mozart at your age, so he's making a gesture that suggests that he's weighing things in both hands. So, you know, I start to laugh. As a historian, I say, "What did he die of?" "The plague," I think. "Oh, geez." "Yeah, and God loves you at least as much as he loved Mozart." Okay, let's go back to loving each other in silence for a little bit. A hilarious number of letters basically start with, "You think you have it bad? Listen to this," followed by a litany of complaints. The weirdest part is not simply that, yes, I do feel like stage cancer is sort of rough, but they're usually written by old people at the end of long lives. A 73-year-old woman named Trudy writes me to say that cancer can't be nearly as bad as learning she was adopted. Can't they both be bad? The world of pain is being calculated, and according to some, compassion can only be doled out by the teaspoon. I can't fully understand the people who write to say sorry, their lives have been grand. I receive long accounts of how deeply satisfied some people are with their many, many achievements. "Younger by the day," boasts an elderly pastor. One man even has the confidence to tweet at me repeatedly, saying that in his many, many years of research, he is, in fact, the authority on early death. But many people write to me like family. As a father, I'm truly sorry. As a mom, I wish I could hug you right now. They want to comfort me, but their own experiences tell me and tell them that life isn't fair. "I want you to know how much I'm praying for you and I'm grateful for your faith. I'm sorry that we must say, like Job, though he slay me, yet I will love him." Yes, yes. Yet I will love him. It's Palm Sunday, and the children in Sunday school the children's Sunday schools closed, who were faced with the terror of having a two-year-old in the main service. So we mill around for a little with the other parents, waiting for something to happen before finally giving up and heading toward the sanctuary. The mystery of the empty Sunday school classrooms is solved the instant we walk up into the main double doors and see the church swimming with children. They spin in circles. They climb on top of each other. Mostly they hit each other with palm fronds. I catch my husband's eye as I hold Zach like a prized lamb as I walk into the Sunday service. In Christian art, a palm frond is a symbol of martyrdom, a little reminder to the viewer that this saint has earned his or her status in blood. But at every Easter service, the only martyrdom apparent is that every child is about 3 seconds away from getting a palm frond in the eyeball. A tired volunteer still manages to smile and hands one to my two-year-old. Zach is delighted. Suddenly, the organ music swells, and the doors fly open, and the procession has begun. It is, as all children's programming is, completely absurd and wonderful. Some children refuse to move past the rows that hold their parents. Others sprint ahead, and three begin to cry. But most are still trying to hit their brothers in the face. Zach is utterly still as he takes in the view, and I know what he is seeing. In his small world, he has not yet seen vaulted ceilings and warm wood beams and windows after window of colored glass. One of his arms is wrapped around my neck and the other is pointing everywhere as his wide blue eyes scan the room. We march up to the front of the sanctuary and everyone is smiling broadly as they stomp around the room. So taken are we by the specter of radiant youth that nobody is looking at the hymnal and the space fills with loud, unselfconscious singing. I catch Tobin's eye and hold Zach up a little higher, and I can tell Tobin's not trying not to cry. We're thinking the same thing. Is this one of those moments? Sorry. The kind that he will have to look back on alone. I hold Zach up a little higher so he can wave his leaf in the air, and I try to smile as a few tears trickle down my cheeks. I know where Palm Sunday falls in the story of our God. Jesus is on a donkey, trudging into Jerusalem, waving their arms in the air, tattered coats thrown down before the one who marches toward his death. It is a celebration. It is a funeral. Holding Zach in my arms 15 days before my next scan. I wish I knew the difference. My inbox is filled with strangers giving me reasons. People offer them to me like wildflowers they picked up along the way. A few people want me to cultivate spiritual acceptance. We have had millions of births and deaths in different life forms, explains a Hindu woman gently. Don't worry, this life shall pass and your soul will move on to the next step. The world is a place filled with suffering, they write, a garden full of weeds that we tend as best we can. Either way, learn to accept God's plan. What if everything is random? Many people write. A woman who has left the faith for science writes, I find it comforting to believe that the universe is random because then the God I believe in is no longer cruel. This is a painful conclusion for many who comb through the details of their tragedy and find no evidence that God was ever there. The world, it seems, is filled with mothers and fathers begging for their children's lives and hearing nothing but silence. And ever after, every church service that sings that God is good rattles like tin in their ears. There can only be one reasonable conclusion, says a father whose children have all been cut down. No one is listening. It's a weird world where everything suddenly feels dark, but oddly enough, I find that the most, sorry for my just bevy of random tissues now, cry in front of strangers I now love. But one of the weirdest parts is how often in the midst of the darkness, everyone is really busy telling you to be grateful. I was sitting with my friend Jody, and her head was in her hands. Her mom was dying, and it was just exhausting. Everything was exhausting. But I'm sure you're feeling really fortunate for all the shared time you had together, I say. She looks up abruptly, catching my tone. Oh, so very fortunate, she replies, with a tone that suggests that homicide is a viable option for people who say these kinds of things. People keep telling me how fortunate I am. I let the sarcasm drop from my voice and put my hand on her shoulder. I'm sorry, hon. I wish I never had to hear the words, at least, again. At least I'm at a top-rate medical facility. At least I'm trying the new drug. Yesterday, I found out that my insurance got screwed up and they sent my bill to debt collectors. Debt collectors. We look at each other with the shared weariness of people tired at the oars. So guess what someone said? No, she says. Yeah, they said, at least you have the financial and intellectual resources to deal with it. She gave a low whistle. Why is everyone trying to teach us lessons? She asks. And we both feel tired just thinking about it. So I've noticed there are three kinds of lessons people keep trying to teach me. Actually, my very favorite was a man who wrote all this to me on a church bulletin in a Lutheran church in Iowa, and then he was so lazy that he didn't type it up. He just mailed it to me. So then I wrote his pastor. I was like, Dear Pastor Gary, one of your parishioners seems not to be paying attention to the main service. Best wishes. Kate Bowler. There are three kinds of lessons I find people are trying to teach me. The first is that I shouldn't be upset because the significance of death is relative. So I like to call them the minimizers. Some people do it spiritually by reminding that in the end, cosmically, death doesn't matter. It's all the same, writes a woman in the prime of her youth, and she includes a lot of praying hand emoticons. A lot of Christians like to remind me that heaven is my true home. Which makes me want to ask them if they want to go home soon, maybe now. Atheists, I find, can be equally trite by demanding that I give up my search for meaning. People want me to know that my faith is holding me hostage to an inscrutable God, so just let go of the guesswork. But the message is the same. Stop complaining and accept the world as it is. We can't always get what we want, is an answer along those same lines. It reminds me of the many times in studying the prosperity gospel that I was chided for complaining. But my very favorite was one time when I was actually in that Orlando fog machine display. There was a place where you could tack up your prayers in the garden, in the fake garden of Gethsemane. And I was, you know, I like to, like, participate in things, so I wrote up a little prayer, and I was just about to tack it on, and I realized there was already a prayer tacked on right in the middle, and it said, I pray that Jan and Paul Crouch, who own the thing and also TBN, will spend more money on employee compensation and less on golden lions. And it was true. The place was filled with golden lions. And but complaining is not really a theological virtue. The second response focuses on how this experience is supposed to be teaching me lessons to improve my mind, body, and spirit. I suppose that this is the ultimate test of faith for you, one man writes and asks that I have the good sense to accept God's will. Anyway, he says at the close of the letter, I'll pray for your remission, and if you die, that your suffering is minimal. Thanks, Joe, from Indiana. Sometimes I want every know-it-all when they send me a note to let me know when they're facing the grisly specter of death, and then I'll send them a cat poster that says, hang in there. I hope you have a Job experience, writes one man bluntly, and I just cannot think of anything worse to wish for somebody. I think the third is the harshest. It comes from the solutions people who are already a little disappointed that I'm not saving myself. Keep smiling. Your attitude determines your destiny, says Jane from Idaho. And I am completely worn out by the tyranny of prescriptive joy. But not all lessons people are the spiritual types. I went to a wonderfully hippie college who are desperate to save me with the kale that they are growing in their organic gardens. And or the cancer conspiracy movies that I get a lot, where big pharmaceuticals are trying to murder me at this very moment. And so they're all very concerned that I eat the special diet they have just emailed me. And all of this is usually just short of the dying words of the last leprechaun, but you have this overwhelming sense of urgency in which this one secret formula has been found. And because of my background in the prosperity gospel, I receive hundreds of letters from people already inside the movement. usually ones crushed by the weight of this very solution-focused theology, who've been unable to grieve. A Nigerian woman sits through weekly meetings at her job, encouraging her to talk faith talk, but she wants to acknowledge that outside of her office window, the bodies of abandoned babies are collected and being hauled away in black refuse bags. A bitter seed has been planted in a young father who must take his brain-dead child off of life support while his extended family, steeped in prosperity theology, rails against him for his inability to prevent his child's death. I've gotten so many letters like that, the laments of bereaved parents who are asked to keep a smile on their faces. In fact, the day I got home from the hospital, I got a number of calls from people, leaders, famous leaders I'd interviewed, who said, I'm so sorry this is happening to you. I'm also very sick, and I have no one to tell. And hearing that from a televangelist or a megachurch pastor who is locked in by his own or her own theology, it's an exhausting kind of trial to face. So I get hundreds and hundreds of letters, and I find that they're telling me what, but they or why. But the ones I really pay attention to are the ones who talk about who. When you were afraid that the end had come, were you alone? This man writes this long letter to me about how when he'd been traveling, he'd been taken hostage by his family, with his family, and he had watched very helplessly as intruders had pressed guns against his kids' noses and threatened his wife with rape. But he felt that God was somehow there, and he couldn't explain it. He couldn't explain who loosened the ropes and let his family escape unharmed, and he'll never understand why he survived when his neighbor was found outside hanging by a rope. And he doesn't rationalize why some people are rescued and others are hanged. And he doubts that there's a way that God redeems the situation by extracting the good from them. But he knows God was there because he felt peace, indescribable peace, and it changed him forever. And so his letter ends with a shrug. I have no idea how this works, but I wish this for you as you move forward. And I found his description matched something that I'd read in the Near-Death Experience Research Foundation, which is actually a thing, which is so weird. But it collects people's near-death experiences from a variety of things, from car accidents to suicide attempts to. And many people describe the same odd thing, love. I think I would have ignored the article if it hadn't reminded me of something that had happened to me, something I felt too uncomfortable to tell anyone. It seemed odd and too simplistic to say what I knew to be true, is that when I thought I was gonna die, I didn't feel angry. I felt loved. It was those first few moments of my diagnosis when I was in the hospital and I couldn't see my son and I couldn't get out of bed. And they were saying that I probably wouldn't survive the year. But something like a secret about faith felt like it had been uncovered. In lucid moments, I found my feelings so difficult to explain. I kept saying the same thing. I don't want to go back. I don't want to go back. And even at the time, I knew that was a weird thing to say. Surely I wanted to go back to the life I had. And to be honest, I still really miss it. I miss pettiness. Like, I miss having petty thoughts about things, like people who write scholarly articles that aren't that good, that use stuff that I wanted to write about, or feeling annoyed at what Dana from high school is doing. I miss pettiness. I miss the trite things that felt so important. I miss the rhythms of a life that felt like it would go on and on. I miss it. And yet, at a time when I felt like I should be abandoned by God, I was not reduced to ashes. I felt honestly like I was floating on the love and prayers of all those who hummed around me, bringing notes and flowers and socks and embroidered quilts and words of encouragement. And these people came into me and revealed to me the face of Jesus. That feeling stayed with me for months, so much so that I started to feel a little panicked. What do I do when I have to go? I just, church historian, I knew that the feeling wouldn't remain. So what am I going to do when it's gone? So I asked historians and pastors and theologians, and they knew what I meant because they'd either felt it themselves or read about it in works of Christian theology. St. Augustine called it the sweetness Thomas Aquinas called it something mystical, like the prophetic light, but all said, yes, it will go, the feelings will go, the sense of God's presence will go, and there will be no lasting proof that God exists, and there will be no formula for how to get it back. But it offered me a little bit of certainty, and I clung to it like a raft. When the feelings recede like the tide, they said, yes, they will go, but they will leave an imprint. I will somehow be marked by the presence of an unbidden God. And since we're talking about certainty today, that is not proof. It's not proof of anything. I wish I could write a pamphlet. 5 steps for how to guarantee God's peace in the midst of horrifying tragedy and the grisly specter of death. All the health and wealth kinds of things I studied for years. But I suppose I'm more like the man who wrote to me to say that he'd seen a friend swinging from a tree and felt the presence of God in the same long, dark night. Yes, that is a God I believe in. So the letters have slowed to a trickle. I still get one or two every day. The one I got on my drive on the way over started with, Dear Kate, my mom died on my first day of kindergarten. And, like, it's a weird life I lead now. Like, it's a weird kind of ministry. But what it's taught me is so much about the problem, I think, with formulas. The problem with certainty is they are generic and bland. They are universal and uncompromising. And there's just nothing generic about the human life. When I was little, I used to... I'm from the worst part of Canada, and I used to have to put on snow boots that went up to here and trudge across a field so big that if we got stuck, my sister would have to fully pull me out. I am really good in the stern of a canoe, but I never got the hang of riding a bike with no hands. I always used to see the northern lights when I was a kid because my parents would wake us all up to show us the sky painted with colors. And I spent weeks of my childhood riding around on a bike saving worms after a rain. My hair is my favorite feature, even though now it's curly because of chemo, which is so weird. And I still can't parallel park. There is no life in general. God is universal, but we are not. I am Tobin's wife, and I'm Zach's mom, and I'm Karen and Jerry's daughter. And as I was writing this, I wrote, and I'm here now, bolted in time and place to the busy sounds of a blonde boy in dinosaur pajamas crashing into every piece of furniture. Who's my baby? I ask him. Zach is running long loops and running a car along every edge. He stops and turns to me. A boy? He says, hopefully. Yes, I say, scooping him into my arms. He tolerates a tight hug for a few breaths and then squirms his way out laughing. Yes, but not just any boy. You. Thanks so much for having me. Sorry, I'm kind of a mess today.
Okay, we've got a few minutes for questions.
Yeah.
Yeah, advice on how to take it better, maybe.
You want the microphone?
Thank you for that beautiful sharing. I had read your article some time ago. But what I wondered is, pardon me? Can't hear. Is this better? Okay, pardon me. I was wondering, you did not directly address, and I was curious, in the time you spent looking at this gospel of prosperity and these mega churches, what was your feeling toward them? I mean, did you accept their basic premise, or was it always just a study for you?
No, there's almost nothing about the prosperity gospel theologically I find myself relating to. But what I found so odd, which is why I focused on this, is that their intoxicating formulas, which I thought is so foreign to me and I do not believe in, were almost the same formulas that people gave me every day in various forms. So the idea that we all have a prosperity gospel became more interesting and more consuming for me than the fact that I found them, they're theologically sort of absurd. Yeah. Oh, we both have the same lovely mentor who has the kind of endless charity model, which he wrote one of the first big books about Pentecostalism, which Pentecostals had always been made fun of and thought of as kind of the wrong side of the tracks faith. And it's actually why my razzle-dazzle prosperity talk goes very well in Episcopalian crowds, because it's really fun to make fun of you all about money, right? It's awkward. So trying to make those kinds of fun comparisons between a gospel of endless wealth and the kind of accidental performative things we sometimes do is what I usually do in a Sunday school. It just ended up oddly consuming my life in a horrifying way. Yeah.
You have a loud voice?
What happens when it doesn't go well? A couple things. They write me private letters. I mean, and I actually think trying to find exhaust valves for lives that don't work out is a huge part. So there's a lot of break taking. If they find that like they didn't get the promotion or it didn't work out, then yeah, they very often will either take breaks and say we'll come back later, or they hide it. There's a strong, I mean, fake it till you make it is actually a theological principle for them. They really think you can perform your way into releasing the spiritual forces that will bring it into reality. Yeah, that's why it was so weird to be both the expert and then the evidence at some point. I thought I would get more mean letters from people saying, yeah, you deserve it, and I did get some of that because I didn't theologically accept the premise that I made sarcastic jokes in front of you. I've clearly unleashed negative forces. But the number of people who, I mean, we all saw Eddie Long died this last week, famous megachurch, black megachurch preacher, famous prosperity preacher, and he hid his cancer till the very end. They would much rather hide it than face not having lived up to their own theology. I used to see some of them in the cancer center sometime. It was really, I was like, hi. Go ahead. Sure. So people think of it mostly as just a belief in money, that God gives you money. But I think of it as four things. One is the power of a special theology of faith, in which faith is the ability to use words in a way that unleashes spiritual forces that brings things into reality. So to have faith, to talk faith, all those things are codes for using your mind as a spiritual incubator to make things happen. How do you know if your faith is working? Health and wealth. So they primarily use the wallet and the body as ways to check to see if your faith is working. And then the fourth tenet is victory, the overarching sense that all things, every aspect of your life will come in conformity with your faith. So from your kids' obedience to the house you get to the feelings of optimism you have when you wake up into the morning, that your entire life will be evidence of this faith at work. It was mostly kicked off in the 50s, but the theological infrastructure starts in the late 19th century. Yes. Yeah. 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 Totally. And I think So she said, don't you think that's just kind of was true also in Jesus' time, that the rich must be more blessed and that the poor are cursed? And I think it's true that theologically we tend to work backwards from our biographies. What's happening? We just look for the evidence and then draw conclusions from it. And I think that's always been true. It also has scriptural threads. Proverbs is annoying for the amount that it includes. Like, never have I seen the righteous go hungry. Really? Never? Yes, but then there's, but that's why scripture is this incredible conversation about whether people's lives fully reflect the glory of God. I mean, Job ends with a question. Where were you when the foundations of the earth were laid? So in the end, our wrestling, our quest for certainty usually, I mean, it dissolves, right? It dissolves, yeah. So the very astute comment was, don't you think certainty is a quest for control and it's a lot like magic? I write a lot about that. I think that's absolutely right. Now, we typically use a word like magic, though, for things we don't agree with, right? It's just causal language that we don't want to put weight down on. But I think theologically, we are obsessed with control, and we all want to guarantee that this experiment called the human life is going to work out to our advantage. And unfortunately, the Christian tradition offers us no guarantees. Yeah. On that note...